Dean of Westminster Abbey, Lords, ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome from me as well in this, at one and the same time, grand and intimate space. I'm looking forward very much to hearing Claire's lecture. Many of you here, I think, will have heard the first two lectures in the series, those addressing moral dilemmas in our goals and in our duties, how to act within an ethical and moral framework. It's a very important question. The answers are very difficult. So we come now, as Stephen has said, to the final lecture, Moral Acting and Moral Courage, and who better, and indeed who more practiced, to deliver the third lecture is, of course, Claire Foster Gilbert. Her credentials, as many of you will also know, for this task, are impeccable. She has been an academic, an educationalist. She's worked for 8 years in the religious context in the Bishop's House and is now director of the Westminster Abbey Institute that aims to bring those public servants surrounding Parliament Square together to consider these weighty but vital issues. I think we'll have the opportunity after Claire's lecture to take up some of the themes in discussion of not just this lecture but all three lectures, and I'm looking forward to that very much indeed. But immediately, let me say how delighted I am to introduce Claire Foster Gilbert.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, at my 21st birthday party, my father made a speech at which he told this anecdote. A cockerel had been purchased by a farmer to service his hens. Full of bright promise and good intentions, the cockerel went to the hen coop to start his work and found that he was incapable. He failed miserably. The hens cackled at him and shooed him out of their coop. Flopping around the farmyard, distressed as anything, feeling useless and foolish, the cockerel found himself drawn, despite himself, to a field of cows where, without a shadow of a doubt, and clearly with great skill and enjoyment, the bull was performing the very service at which the cockerel had been so dreadfully lacking. The cockerel drooped miserably on the fence by the side of the field. The bull, having finished his day's work, sauntered over to the cockerel. "What's up, old chap?" he asked. "I failed," said the cockerel. "I'm supposed to do to the hens what you've just been doing to the cows, and I failed. I just can't seem to manage." The bull was sympathetic. "I've a solution for you," he said. The cockerel brightened. "Really?" "It always works, believe me," said the bull, with total conviction. "Tell me," said the cockerel eagerly. "I'll do anything you say." "For the next 3 days," said the bull, looking straight at the cockerel, "nibble a bit from the edge of my droppings. You can choose the drier ones. Just a bit, every day, for 3 days. You should find that does the trick." The cockerel, though slightly disgusted, did as the bull recommended. For 3 days, he nibbled at the droppings. Nothing seemed to change. He felt as droopy and useless as ever until the evening of the third day when, as if by magic, he perked up. So much so that he went straight to the hen coop and, taking no nonsense from the hens, performed his duty on every one of them. It took till midnight. He was so thrilled at his success that he flew up to the highest point in the farmyard, the roof of the farmhouse, threw his head back and let out the loudest cock-a-doodle-doo in Christendom. The farmer, wakened suddenly and violently from a deep sleep, leapt out of bed, grabbed his gun, ran out of the front door and shot the cockerel, who died instantly. "And the moral of the story is," said my father at my 21st birthday party, "if you get to the top through bullshit, don't crow about it." Tonight, we will look at stories. Stories that inspire, stories that lie, stories we tell of ourselves and those that others tell of us. This story, which I have never forgotten, taught a necessary humility and indeed a profound awareness of the role of others in all my achievements. To recap the last 2 weeks, in the first lecture, I offered a framework for ethical analysis to assist clear thinking in moral decision-making, drawn from the Western philosophical canon. I suggested that a proposed action be scrutinized from goal-based, duty-based, and right-based perspectives. Goal-based to consider what the proposed action was trying to achieve and whether those goals were desirable and good. Duty-based to consider what had to be done in order to achieve the goals and whether the means were acceptable, not to justify the ends, but intrinsically. And right-based to consider whether those most affected by the proposed action were happy with it, had their consent been sought. With such an analysis at hand, I suggested, moral thinking would become clearer, if not easier. Strengthening moral courage in thinking means exercising these analytical skills, allowing our minds to stretch when apparently mutually exclusive moral goods compete, and being ready to be quickly decisive if called upon, knowing what compromises had been made and why. The image I left you with was that of a three-legged stool that stands firm even on rocky ground. Last week, we considered what it was to feel moral. We looked at four perceptions of the world around us, drawn from the Judeo-Christian tradition, to help us see the world with new eyes, to feel our connection with everything else, to feel, as Hildegard of Bingen said, that God made everything in the world in consideration of everything else. And so to be conscious of the fact that everything we do has an effect on everything else. That was the creation covenant perception. Then there was the sense of the sacred, that everything in creation is loved by God and is therefore to be treated with deep respect. There is nowhere called away where we can throw things. Thirdly, the priesthood of humanity saw the human family as guests at a feast, receiving the good things of creation as gifts, not rights. Finally, the Sabbath feast of enoughness permitted us and all of creation to rest. And the image I left you with last week was that of a three-dimensional spider's web in which everything is connected. Strengthening moral courage in emotion means falling in love with the whole, facing the global challenges of climate change, sustainable development, trade, and finance, which are all connected. Then the three approaches of goal-based, duty-based, and right-based thinking can be brought into play, but in a much bigger, more joined up and global world than we had been aware of hitherto. In practical terms then, one starts with the lesson of lecture two, the feeling or orientation of love for all, and then applies lecture one, using analytical skills to consider the moral choices one faces on a daily basis. And so finally this week, I want to look at moral acting. What gives us the courage to act? It is one thing to experience beautiful feelings of connectedness and responsibility, then to have worked out on paper, as it were, what is right. It is quite another to stand up and take a step forwards. I promised last week that I would show how to travel from a high moral vision to its achievement, citing the example of JF Kennedy as the one who inspired US citizens to see beyond national self-interest to the good of all and who showed the way to get there. This week's lecture will describe a path from thinking and feeling morally to acting morally. The material I'm going to use comes from Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces. I am once again indebted, this time to Luke Parsons QC, for introducing me to this work. With Luke, I co-founded the Ethics Academy, which teaches ethics to young people and others using the storytelling approach found in Campbell. Campbell was a social anthropologist and understood myth and the power of myth better than anyone I have come across before. He shows how in every myth that has ever been told, there is a common thread or plot in which the protagonist or hero embarks on a quest that transforms him or her, and from which he or she returns with the elixir that in turn serves others. This monomyth describes the journey of the self into virtue and communitarian ethics, hence our use of it for young people, and we will look at it together tonight. But there are two lenses I want to use because of the particular circumstances of these lectures. One is that the hero of the story, because it is us and we are public servants, starts knowing that this journey is not about me. The public servant acts, by virtue of his or her title, for others. That is what the Nolan principles point the public servant towards, all of them. Moreover, we can also think of the story as being about the development of the collective, the community, institution, nation, or human family. Because we are public servants, we can let our minds work on the story in this non-individualistic way. The other lens I want to suggest is that rather than use the word hero, I will use the word pilgrim, removing the connotations of specialness that hero implies, and joining us with the countless thousands who have journeyed to this holy place over the centuries. So, think of your life, or that of your institution, as a film. You, unique you, like whom there never has been and never will be anyone, ever, are the protagonist of the film Life of Maurice Sarchi. What kind of a film has your life been so far? Everybody can think of this, not just Maurice. Romantic comedy, tragedy, thriller. And what kind of a pilgrim have you been so far? Are you enjoying yourself? Are you challenged? Or are you bored? Are you open to new possibilities? Do you know who or what you want to be? What sets your belly on fire? Or do you feel as though you are treading a well-worn path through a thousand weary days of getting dressed and going to work, feeding the family, a slave to the quotidian calls on your time and your purse, with no clear idea of what you're doing or where you are going? Do you feel even more of a victim than that? Are you bullied? Are you physically or mentally challenged in some way that makes you feel you are being held back from doing what you have always wanted to do? What would you do if you were not afraid? In the story, this stage, the first stage, is called the ordinary world. This is where the story begins. It is your platform, your comfort zone. But something is calling you out of it. Stage two, hearing the call, which may come from inside you or outside you, may have been something you've heard before. You may have heard such a call, a vocation to public service. It is undeniable, and often unwelcome. In the Ethics Academy, we use film clips to illustrate the stages, and one such, loved by the boys, as it happens, is from The Matrix. Neo, the main character, takes delivery of a mobile phone that rings as he picks it up. Morpheus, the voice that speaks, confirms Neo's hunch that there is more to life than the world the Matrix has created around him. Morpheus tells Neo to climb out of a 30-story building onto some scaffolding. That is Neo's call. And he can't do it. The third stage of the journey is refusing the call. It's an important stage. We've all had the experience, perhaps, of leaping too enthusiastically at a suggestion, rushing into action, and falling flat on our faces. Refusing the call is the moment when you take stock and question the wisdom of the call. But it can also be the rearing up of fear and self-doubt. You are scared. It's a step into the dark. You know it's going to present difficulties, and you don't know if you are up to dealing with them. It's a move out of your ordinary, safe, comfortable world. So you refuse the call. But then, as you sit around in your now profoundly dissatisfied state, thinking of all the hundreds of reasons why you shouldn't start, and knowing they are sounding increasingly unconvincing, you meet someone who knows what you are capable of, believes in you, and the vision of your journey, and knows how to help you take the first step. You meet your mentor, stage four. In The Matrix, the mentor is Morpheus, who teaches Neo. In Lord of the Rings, another classic hero's journey, it is Gandalf. Or the ballet teacher played by Julie Walters in Billy Elliot, and so on. It may be someone you briefly meet, or even a book or a painting. Whatever or whoever it is, the mentor knows you have it in you to respond to the call. The mentor stands still. Note to helicopter parents and micromanagers, stands still and does no more than point in the right direction and believe in the ability of the pilgrim to go there. And then, stage five, you cross the threshold. You make a commitment to the journey. This is a profound moment, a step into the dark. You have said yes to change without fully knowing what that will entail, or whether you will be able to manage what it does entail. You have surrendered the safe control of your ordinary world, cut the ties, left the known shore. One of the clips the Ethics Academy used to illustrate this stage is the Council of Elrond scene in Lord of the Rings, favored by the girls. Frodo has brought the ring as far as Rivendale, the kingdom of the elves, and Elrond, the king of the elves, has summoned all the goodies together, the dwarves, the humans, the elves, Gandalf, Frodo. The ring sits in the middle of the group as the group ponders what to do. Elrond forestalls any notion that the power of the ring might be used against Sauron, the evil one. He knows, as by now does Frodo, that its power is itself evil and will change those who try to make it serve their purpose. Moreover, it is stronger than anyone present, which Gimli the dwarf discovers when he tries to smash the ring with his axe. Elrond declares that the ring must be destroyed, and the only way that it is going to happen is if it is thrown back into the fire whence it was forged. The fire at the heart of Mordor. A row erupts. One does not simply walk into Mordor, guarded by a 1,000 army of orcs. And who is going to have charge of the ring? The dwarves and elves do not trust each other. The humans are divided, and soon everyone is on his feet, shouting to be heard. We see Frodo looking at the ring and wincing at the noise, as if the ring was already working its evil power on those present, turning them against each other. And then, in the midst of the row, Frodo stands up. And of course, he is only half the height of anyone present except Gimli. He says, "I will take the ring to Mordor." At first, no one hears him, so he says it again, and silence falls. "I will take the ring to Mordor," he says, "but I do not know the way." This is Frodo crossing the threshold, stage 5, stepping into darkness, knowing that he will be stretched beyond anything he can imagine and not knowing if he will make it through. And then, one by one, each of the council members declares his support. "I will be your guide," says Aragorn. "You will have my bow," says Legolas the elf. "And my axe," says Gimli. "I will help you in any way I can," says Gandalf. And then the three other hobbits emerge from the bushes, determined not to be left out. And so the Fellowship of the Ring is formed, but only after the pilgrim has crossed the threshold. And that does seem to be the way the stories, our stories, go. The really worthwhile things are only attainable if we make a commitment to the journey towards them, and the help on the way only emerges after the commitment has been made. Note, the help is indispensable. The journey is about community, not individuality. Frodo could not have done it without the help of the Fellowship, but he still had to show leadership in making the commitment in faith and trust and hope. Stage 6, trials, allies, and enemies, is the journey itself beginning in earnest, and this is where the pilgrim learns who his or her allies are and who are the enemies. You face obstacles and learn which are unreal and of your own making, such as fear, and overcome them. You face trials, you make mistakes, you fall over, you get up. You realize that the journey is not about you at all, but about everyone else. In other words, you grow in moral courage and discernment. Trials, allies, and enemies. The journey is changing you. In all the great stories and endeavors, there comes a point on the journey when everything goes wrong. This is stage 7, facing the darkness. Your friends have deserted you. You have forgotten why you started on the journey. You are uncertain and afraid, and everything you thought you had learned seems to have gone, along with your allies. Here's an example from Martin Luther King. Around midnight, as he struggled to sleep, the phone rang one more time. "Listen, nigger," an ugly voice crackled over the wire. "We're tired of you and your mess now. If you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out and blow up your house." King paced the bedroom floor in angry fear, then walked across the hall to the kitchen and heated some coffee. He tried to find solace in what theology and philosophy had taught him about the meaning of evil. Could there be food without evil? Could there be redemption without sin? No answer came to shake his despair. Nothing relieved the fear in his gut. He was ready to give up. He discovered at this midnight hour that religion had to become real to me, not merely the hand-me-down family business. And he said, "I had to know God for myself." With my head in my hands, I bowed down over that cup of coffee. Oh yes, I prayed a prayer. I prayed out loud that night. The words I spoke to God that midnight are still very vivid in my memory. "Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I think the cause that we represent is right. But Lord, I must confess that I am weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. I'm afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership. I can't let the people see me like this, because if they see me weak and losing my courage, they will begin to get weak. I'm at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. If we have been through this story once or twice, we know afterwards that the darkest hour is just before the dawn. The absolute darkness is only an appearance because there is a bend in the tunnel. And once you reach the corner, you will see the light at the end. If you are going through hell, keep going. The darkness fades, as for Martin Luther King, with the light breaking through. As he put it, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced him before. Sometimes it is because the time simply passes and stage 8, the great ordeal, is nigh. This is the high point towards which the journey has been inexorably moving, the moment you have been being trained for in the testing stages of the journey, and everything in you is ready, even if it doesn't feel like it at the time. The speech, the giving birth, the match, the performance, the job interview, election day, and so on. This story, all the more powerful for the diffidence of his speech, comes from a former head of MI5. I was put in mind by the hero's journey narrative of our collective leadership experience over 2005-6 with the 7-7 attacks and the 21-7 failed attacks. Paradoxically, the high point was not 7-7, but 21-7. Coming 2 weeks to the day after 7-7, we were already tired, and 21-7 made us fear that there was a whole series of these attacks already planned, and of which we knew nothing, on top of which the 21-7 perpetrators had got away and could have another go. That was a really terrifying thought, institutionally and personally. Of course, all you can do is take a deep breath, press on, and trust that by doing your jobs well and applying what you have learnt, you will turn the corner. In a sense, we did with the discovery of the 21-7 attacker's hideout in West London. Remember the photos of the man on the balcony in his boxers. That wasn't the end of it, and that autumn was tough, with wave after wave of credible intelligence of terrorists plotting against the UK. In October, we got to a point where we started to worry that we would be unable to respond to any new reporting. Again, you keep plugging away. And finally, with the disruption of the liquid bomb plot and other less well-remembered operations that summer of 2006, we seemed to have gained the initiative and to be able to breathe again. That wasn't the end of the struggle, but it did seem we had turned a corner and achieved some breathing space. The great ordeal, then, is not necessarily a big, exciting moment, but can be a grueling test of endurance and skill and intelligence under pressure that doesn't let up. Those MI5 officers just kept putting one pilgrim foot in front of another. The ninth stage is claiming the prize. For the public servant or the pilgrim hero, the prize that is only for him or her is not the real prize. The trophy, or the election, or the vote in Parliament, or being the one to ensure the bomb plot fails. Baroness D'Souza tells this story. I was in post-Taliban Afghanistan in early 2002, a still traumatized country reeling from the Soviet occupation, the civil war, and the reign of terror by the Taliban. I came across a small bundle of energy and goodness called Aziz Royesh, who had started a school for girls in a half-ruined hut, teaching about 30 children in 3 shifts. To cut a long, long story short, I was so impressed by him and what he aimed to do, a man who had been educated at a Red Cross primary school when he was a refugee in Pakistan, that I began to raise funds in really small amounts for him. Over the years, the school, Marifat High School, has flourished and become what has been called the St. Paul's of Kabul, with 3,000 students, half of whom are girls, and over 95% of whom go on to higher university education all over the world, but who return to teach at the mother school. It is an outstanding success driven by this man, and is providing cohorts of young people who are Afghanistan's future leaders and who are versed in the liberal arts, including ethics, civic duties, human rights, and languages, as well as the sciences. Frances had to stop visiting when she became Lord Speaker for security reasons, but to her delight, her daughter became involved, a journalist who was, in her words, at the rather frivolous end, Vogue and the like. Frances's prizes were not for herself. My joy at the development of the school is matched by witnessing the development of my daughter into the person she has become through a chance encounter with a society that is living and has always lived on the edge of brutality, war, and extreme poverty. The journey does not end with the prizes. There is a critical 10th stage, a new level of life, where, transformed by our journey, individually or collectively, we stand ready to continue our lives' journeys as servant leaders, strong in ourselves, with moral courage and discernment thoroughly awakened and exercised. This is the way to inspire ourselves and others, not only to feel and think morally, but also to act. The pilgrim's journey is a dynamic map. Most worthwhile endeavors follow a similar trajectory. Like J.F. Kennedy, we describe our noble vision beyond the horizon of narrow self-interest, and we describe the path to that place where we all long in our heart of hearts to be, knowing the journey will not be easy, because no worthwhile endeavor is easy. Being human isn't easy. None of our choices and actions is completely right. We are fallible people in a confusing world. Joseph Campbell said that life is like coming into a cinema in the middle of a film, not being allowed to ask anyone what is going on, and leaving before the end, and still having to make decisions. I have offered some structure, but I know as well as any of you that structures can only make a limited sense of what is a bigger mystery than any of our brains can fathom. God made the angels to show him splendor, as he made animals for innocence and plants for their simplicity. But man he made to serve him wittily in the tangle of his mind, as Thomas More said to his daughter Margaret in the play Man for All Seasons. Tonight we have been telling stories. One of the prices those in public office pay is that others tell stories about you. They are caricatures and they can be cruel. Here are stories about the public servants around Parliament Square, told and retold by lazy minds not prepared to find out the truth. Elected public servants with brittle egos, currying favor, like celebrities desperately seeking attention, motivated by ambition, bending like reeds in the wind that blows according to consumer preferences, having to seek and then retain power, greedy and feeling entitled. Non-elected politicians of the upper house, safe in their lifelong ermine, fatly claiming expenses for doing little, and outrageously accepting the existence of the all-male bishop's bench. The judges, taking advantage of the low esteem in which politicians are held, drawing legislative power craftily into their web. The civil servants, threatened with creeping politicization, burrowing down into their shrinking departments, turning away from the costly responsibility of speaking truth to power, feeling betrayed and victimized as their ministers brief against them and they cannot defend themselves publicly. The police, corrupt and self-serving. The armed forces, warmongering. The mischievous media, telling the story that is too good to check. These are the stories that may be told about you, are told about you. What are the stories you will tell of yourselves? How will you ensure they are good and true? In the spirit of humility, so instilled by the cock and bull story my father told all those years ago, I'd like to offer a different set of narratives. Elected public servants who never lead the nation wrongly through love of power, desire to please, or unworthy ideals, but laying aside all private interests and prejudices, keep in mind their responsibility to seek to improve the condition of all humankind. Members of the upper house who live by and speak authentically from principle to set the tone of legislation, and who scrutinize line by line the bills that pass through their hands to ensure no devil comes to life in the detail. Judges, as the final and just arbiter between the citizen and the state, independent of Parliament, acting transparently, serving justice, not bureaucracy. Civil servants whose steady hand on the tiller holds fast the boat, flexible against the prevailing political winds and the choppy seas of events, dear boy, events, but not so flexible as to swing too far either side of the compass direction of the good. The police and armed services, understanding and serving the societies they were created to protect. Journalists, who empower citizens with clear and relevant information to nourish the national conversation with understanding. These are, or should be, non-negotiables. But they are also ideals from which we all fall short. Hence, I am so taken by the idea of the journey to goodness, rather than the Pelagian requirement to be good, which is actually a Christian heresy. And a journey without pitfalls and mistakes and challenges and scary moments is boring and not really a journey at all. I stand in profound respect of those who take up office, public office. I believe we should give you all our support. We need your strength, your moral strength. But we only deserve your moral strength if we provide the community out of which it can grow. Where else do public servants come from if not from among us? And so, in the end, strengthening moral courage in public life is a call to every one of us to take moral responsibility, to set our faces towards the good and walk towards it together. In which spirit, if this were a science lecture, I would have a final slide with pictures of the team out of whose research my findings, the content of my lectures, would have arisen, in recognition of the fact that all achievements are team efforts. Without the help of a slide, I would like to acknowledge the Dean and Chapter and all my colleagues here at the Abbey for their support and hard work. In particular, I would like to thank the members of the Council of Reference, Kathleen, Sir Stephen, and Canon White for all the help you've given. These lectures truly were a team effort. I left you with two images in the two previous weeks, that of the three-legged stool and that of the three-dimensional spider's web. My last and altogether more glorious and culminating image is the one you have been sitting under for 3 weeks, this glorious canopy of a fan-vaulted ceiling, itself a culmination of the exquisite medieval architecture of this abbey church. Look at it and see the work of anonymous hundreds sprung from the Benedictine foundational vows of obedience, stability, and conversion of manners. We could understand that as humility, sustainability, and community. If they tried to live it, why should not we? So finally, I honour that which this place honours, God, through whom all this, every last part of it, has been possible. Thank you very much.